From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The GOP struggles to define its identity. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. As President Obama goes through the motions of reaching out to Republicans on Capitol Hill, Republicans themselves are going in different directions. Paul Ryan is fighting Obamacare, but accepting its Medicare cuts. Rand Paul wants an end to George W. Bush's wars and limits on executive power. At the Conservative Political Action Conference, a party pep rally, Mitt Romney will defend his losing campaign, but rising star Chris Christie's not even involved. Is there any path toward a future consensus? Can President Obama take advantage of the current confusion? On Reporter's Notebook later on, big challenges for new leaders in China. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. China's outgoing president has admitted that his nation faces many challenges. As new leaders set their priorities, what are the consequences for the U.S. and the rest of the world? We'll talk about that later on Reporter's Notebook. During the rest of our program, we'll be talking about the Republican Party's continued struggle to find new leadership after last year's devastating presidential campaign. And we'll begin with the re-elected President Obama and his so-called charm offensive with Republicans on Capitol Hill. Before making his latest visit, he spoke with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's Good Morning America.
One of the things that, you know, I've discovered in some of these dinners, which has been useful, is that people don't always know what I've actually proposed. And it's a lot easier to have a conversation when there's something specific.
But even the ones who've seen your plan say they need to see more.
Well, I understand, which is why at some point I think I take myself out of this. Right now what I'm trying to do is create an atmosphere where Democrats and Republicans can go ahead, get together, and try to get something done.
Ron Fournier is editorial director of the National Journal. Good to have you on our program.
Great to be here.
You spoke with a White House aide yesterday, and published in your paper that he said this is a joke. We're wasting the president's time and ours. What's going on here?
It's interesting. You had a lot of White House officials, Oren, who in the last 2 or 3 weeks openly mocked and very aggressively mocked any suggestion by anybody, including folks like me in the media, who said the only way you're going to get a deal is if you at least start by getting to know one another. And they just joked at the idea that, you know, maybe a dinner or some outreach might break the logjam. Well, very abruptly, and because his polls started sinking, the president decided to do just that, to open this charm offensive, as you called it. And that left some folks in the White House kind of feeling hung out to dry, that they've been fighting so hard against this idea, and all of a sudden the president is doing it. So some of them, and I'm not saying I know what's on the president's mind, I don't know his motives, but some of the people around the president still feel like this is a silly exercise and there's no way the Republicans are going to bow.
So does this make the president then, the fact that they have spoken so openly as they have, does this make him look sort of silly, given that he's talking with George Stephanopoulos and others and saying that, he really wants to get together and see if he can get something done?
No, I don't think so. I know I was very clear to distinguish what aides were telling me and what the president is doing. And I think a lot of Americans are going to give him credit for at least trying, if, in fact, he is doing this in a credible, sincere, legitimate way. The public doesn't want these two parties to be at loggerheads. They want the deficit issue solved. And if the president is really rolling up his sleeves and getting about the hard work of trying to govern in a divided government, he will get credit for that. So I don't think he looks silly. I think he looks like a leader, just as long as what he's doing is legitimate and does bear fruit.
And whatever aides told you and others, but with the promised anonymity, the White House is saying now publicly, wait a minute, we don't think this is a joke at all. We don't think this is the wasting of the president's time. We think this is serious stuff.
Yeah, Jay Carney was very clear from the podium yesterday that that person was not speaking on behalf of the president. And I personally take the president at his word, and I'm going to be watching to see what he does. He's meeting with lawmakers as we speak, and we'll be doing so three or four times this week. And it's got to be a long, sustained effort. This is not going to happen overnight. But if the president really wants to do what's right for the country, if Speaker Boehner really wants to do what's right for the country, they will find a way to reach an agreement, because you can see the outlines of it there, which is something I explored this morning.
Which group is he meeting with now?
Today's meeting with the, I believe, the Senate Democrats.
Okay, so he has gone caucus to caucus. Has he met with Republicans yet, or is that upcoming?
He does plan to do so.
Okay, so he'll meet first with the Republicans in the Congress, then with the Republicans in the Senate, who, of course, are the minority. So it's the Republicans on the House side that are really important.
Exactly. This really is a game between the Democratic White House and the Republican House of Representatives. And what's happening here is the president needs tax increases, revenue increases out of the House to give him political cover to change entitlements, which his base does not want him to do. The House, the Republicans, need the president to change entitlements, to cut spending, so they have cover to raise taxes. So the irony here is both sides need one another, but neither side trusts the other. And that's why we're in this jam.
Let's go through that again. The president, then, is willing to change entitlements, which his people don't, his Democrats don't want him to do. In what way does he want to change them?
He says he's willing to adjust the CPI, for example, how much automatic increase goes to Social Security. He says he's willing to take a look at at one point he was willing to take a look at the eligibility rate age on Medicare, but he's since taken that off the table. He has said he would do those things. He hasn't done them yet. The Republicans have said, we've already given you $600 billion in tax increases in December. That's our compromise. Now we want you to do all cuts from here on out. What's got to happen for the Republican, this can't happen without more revenue. The only way the Republicans are going to give more revenue if the president's willing to give more entitlement cuts, and the only way the president's going to be able to go against his base and stand up to the American people and say, hey, I'm cutting your benefits and I'm raising taxes, is if he can also show that some money that the Republicans have given as well. So they need each other, but they don't trust one another.
Okay. We're going to be looking at the Republican Party in the rest of our program. Ron Fournier, always good to talk with you, editorial director of the National Journal. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, the Republicans struggle for a new identity on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, here's a bit of what President Obama told ABC News yesterday before his meetings with House Republicans and Senate Republicans.
Ultimately, it may be that the differences are just too wide. If their position is we can't do any revenue, or we can only do revenue if we gut Medicare or gut Social Security or gut Medicaid, if that's the position, then we're probably not going to be able to get a deal.
David Hawkins is former managing editor of CQ Weekly. He's covered Washington for 25 years. His brand new roll call blog is called Hawkins Here. And Hawkins is here on our program. Good to have you.
Thanks for the intro, Warren.
What do you make out of what we heard earlier from Ron Fournier and what the president told Mr. Stephanopoulos?
Well, it does seem as though there could be a little bit of approach avoidance in the president's own sort of attitude towards this. On the one hand, he is on the Hill actually right now. I'm as confused as Ron, because the president is going to Capitol Hill so many times this week that it's hard to keep track. But he actually is in a meeting with the House Republicans right now. So he is keeping the so-called charm offensive going. But at the same time, the reaction to what the president said this morning, or that was broadcast this morning, was sort of a wet blanket, which is, you know, he's really not going to try too hard. And so the Republicans feel, on the one hand, are they being played here? Are they being brought in to sort of give him a little bit of a little bit of cover to make himself look good, when in reality he's already lowered the expectation game to almost nothing.
Why do you say that he's not trying too hard? Earlier we heard him say, what I'm trying to do is create an atmosphere where Democrats and Republicans can go ahead and get together and try to get something done.
Right, but then in that same sentence he said, but then I'm going to get out of the way, which I think was, then it's time for me to step away. Now, his what he has said is that it's necessary for him to do so because he likes to describe himself as essentially toxic into the process in the eyes of so many conservative Republicans, that essentially he's got sort of the reverse Midas touch in the eyes of the House Republicans, that anything he would embrace, they'd be automatically against. So he feels like he needs to get out of the way. But the alternative way of viewing this is that he's going to put them together and create this atmosphere, as he says, for an agreement, knowing that without some sort of heavy presidential involvement and butting heads, no deal is likely to get accomplished.
So the Republicans then simply do not believe that he can stand back and let the Democrats work this out. He's got to get down there in the trenches with them.
Well, that is certainly, what they're saying. Now, on the other hand, there's plenty of sort of credible views, like I guess I'd say, on both sides. Maybe that's because, I'm sort of get paid to be an ideological agnostic here. But it is also the case that the harder he does get into the bargaining, the more the conservative Republicans tend to get the hair on the back of their neck, stand up and say anything, the president wants to negotiate, I'm going to be intuitively and vitriolically against. And so, there's credibility on both sides here that if he negotiates, each side is insisting on sticking with its own ox while goring the others. And if the president is going to insist on raising revenue, they're not going to go near it.
So the president is going to make a speech tonight to Organizing for Action. That's what's left of his presidential campaign, his grassroots effort gearing up to try to create public support around the country for his policies. How closely do you think he will be watched when he makes that speech, and what do you anticipate from it?
Well, he's going to be watched very closely by the base, the so-called political bases on both sides. The liberal base, the people who are exemplified by the people who will be in the room at this fancy, it's one of the nicest and fanciest restaurants in downtown Washington, who are paying a lot of money to hear this dinner. But the people, the other liberal activists around the country, are hoping that the president will sort of give a full-throated defense of the values that prompted them to give so much money and to work so hard for him in the past two elections. And the Republicans are sort of watching to see whether he'll say the same thing, whether essentially after having spent the afternoon on the Capitol trying to make to create the illusion that he's making nice with Republicans, whether he will immediately go downtown and say, don't you worry, I'm not going to sell you out, to his friends. On the other hand, maybe he will do what is known in Washington still 20 years later as a sister soldier moment, essentially going to his political base, like Bill Clinton famously did back when he was running for president, confronted people in his own political base and say, you're going to have to give as much as I'm going to give in order to get anything done. So my guess is that the president will probably try and do straddle the line between those two things, and probably in the end give both sides cause for caution.
David Hawkins again, now with Hawkins Here, a blog on a Roll Call. Robert Costa is National Review's Washington editor. He's also a contributor to CNBC. Good to have you on our program.
Good to join you.
Now, let's talk a bit about what the Republicans are doing in the meantime. First, we have Paul Ryan coming forward with a budget that looks a lot like budgets passed.
Well, that's very true. The Ryan budget arrives this year without much of the fanfare from budgets past. Ryan, fresh off his loss in the presidential election, returns to Capitol Hill slightly humble, but also he's in the middle of a party in disarray. So as the Republican Party tries to find a new message, they're going back to Paul Ryan as an example of steadiness in at least one area of policy, and that's fiscal issues. We hear a lot of discussion about immigration and other fronts where the Republicans may be open to new ideas. But it's on fiscal issues in the budget where they're sticking with Paul Ryan. So his new budget that was outlined on Tuesday is very similar to his previous budgets. It's about tax cuts, entitlement reforms, premium support for Medicare.
It's also about getting rid of Obamacare, although at the same time it retains some of the cuts in Medicare spending that Obamacare requires. So is there a sort of contradiction there?
There is a contradiction in the sense that Ryan pushes for a full repeal of Obamacare in his budget, but in terms of how he reforms Medicare, he does utilize similar cuts to what the legislation has. I sat down with Ryan yesterday in his Capitol Hill office, and the way he explained this is that he's outlining his principles and that he wants to fully repeal Obamacare, but if other aspects of his budget may mirror Obamacare aspects in terms of how it cuts Medicare, well, that's not because he likes Obamacare, but he's just trying to reform Medicare, and there is maybe some slight overlap according to certain perspectives.
Does he have hope of repealing Obamacare this year, or is this something that would take time?
Well, this is a great question, because most people on Capitol Hill and here in Washington, probably across the country, look at the repeal of Obamacare in the House budget as a pipe dream. People say, how could this happen? I mean, how could House Republicans think in a second Obama term with a Democratic Senate that they'd have any shot to repeal Obamacare? It doesn't seem realistic, but Ryan's point to me yesterday was that's a fair argument. But he thinks once Obamacare begins to be implemented, he can make a more public case against the law. He thinks people will sour on it. Of course, that's an arguable point, but that's his perspective.
So does he concede that this is dead on arrival as far as the Senate is concerned, dominated by Democrats as it is? And is this then a statement of principles, sort of to begin the argument?
Well, budgets are always statements of principle. It's very rare for a White House budget or a Senate budget or a House budget in any decade to become law as is. It's always part of a deal process, compromise. And so it is a statement of principle. So is the one from Patty Murray in the Senate with the Senate Democrats. So this is not ever going to become law. Ryan, I think, is very realistic. The reason the Ryan budgets used to be much more important, perhaps, than they are right now is because when there was a potential Republican president, the idea that the Ryan budget could become law was real. And now that Obama's in a second term, this is more just a statement of principle.
Okay. You talked to Paul Ryan in his office. Mm-hmm. Rand Paul came over to your office
at
the National Review.
Yeah,
so he had some very interesting things to say, and of course, in the context of his having filibustered the appointee for leadership of the CIA, but making, according to your interview with him, a lot of other points as well. Elaborate a bit on what he wants to do with regard to changing Republican policy on foreign affairs.
We had a fascinating breakfast with Rand Paul here at National Review on Capitol Hill, our bureau here. And Rand Paul is someone I think is going to run for president in 2016, elected in 2010. Tea Party, Ron Paul wing of the Republican Party, libertarian in many of his views. What he really focused on in our conversation is what happens now in the party after his filibuster of John Brennan's nomination for the CIA. And Rand Paul got a lot of attention for that, of course, but the question now is, now what? What's going to happen next? And he wants to reframe the entire party in foreign policy. He thinks there's war weariness within the party across the country, and he wants to articulate a foreign policy vision that's both post-Bush and post-Romney, and that means less bases abroad, less foreign spending, and less war. And that's really a change in the tone and attitude of a prominent Republican figure.
Now, he filibustered the new head of the CIA based on the use of unmanned drones by President Obama. What he was really going at there was an idea of presidential authority that was promulgated by Bush and Cheney.
That's exactly right. And Rand Paul told me that if, for example, President Bush was still in office and having the same drone program as President Obama, he'd have the same kind of effort on the Senate floor. He is very unhappy with this kind of militaristic executive branch. He thinks he called it the John U faction. Remember the Justice Department official from the Bush years who advocated an enlarged executive, more executive power. Rand Paul was alarmed by this. And he's raising a concern almost on a bipartisan basis. He thinks it was bad during Bush, administration. He thinks the Obama administration has almost continued the Bush administration's executive overreach on foreign policy.
John McCain and Lindsey Graham, old-timers in the U.S. Senate. McCain, of course, a former presidential candidate, referred to Paul, because of what he said, as one of the party's wacko birds.
Rand Paul told me that that was a synonym he wasn't really familiar with, and he chuckled. But he thinks McCain makes it too personal, he says. He thinks he respects McCain, he respects Graham, but when you listen to Rand Paul's 13-hour filibuster regarding drone strikes, Rand Paul never once mentioned the name of John McCain or Lindsey Graham. He did not make it personal, whereas when John McCain and Lindsey Graham came to the floor, they talked about Rand Paul, they expressed their distaste for his maneuver. And so this is the real friction right now in the Republican Party, because John McCain and Lindsey Graham, in a broad sense, are the grandees in the Senate Republican Conference, especially on foreign policy. They're famous with former Senator Joe Lieberman from Connecticut of being the three amigos. These are gentlemen who take trips abroad together. They're often on the floor, or they're ranking members of committees. And so Rand Paul is a threat to their power because he is prominent, has a large fan base politically. And he's challenging their views, which are very much in line with the Bush era.
We have a very interesting situation then shaping up with Rand Paul staking out such very new ground. Very quickly, let me go back to David Hawkins now with the Hawkins Here blog at Roll Call. What do you make of what Rand Paul is doing?
Well, I thought it was a bravura performance. Let me make one sort of different point, which is I think that, paradoxically, the 13-hour filibuster might have actually brought back some verve for the old-fashioned talking filibuster in the Senate. He might have done more for filibuster reform. I'm serious about this than any of the other people who've been talking about it recently, because it worked. We're all talking about it fully a week later. He made his case forcefully. He raised something onto the national consciousness that wasn't really much on the national consciousness. He got what he wanted, and he, again, sort of paradoxically, he used the oldest, a 19th century technique to raise awareness in a new millennial kind of way. It was trending on Twitter. It was a huge hit. It raised them a bunch of money. So for those who say that the silent filibuster in the Senate, you know, where you just sort of sit there and you raise your finger in protest and nobody makes you speak, that should be replaced by a requirement that people actually talk. I think that's going to gain some credibility now that people on both sides have watched how effectively Paul's technique worked.
You said he got what he wanted. What'd you mean?
Well, I mean, what he said he wanted was an assurance from either the president or the attorney general that no American citizen would be struck down by an American drone on American soil, unless he posed an imminent threat. And he said that he'd been asking for that assurance for months and hadn't gotten it. And sure enough, right after he finished talking, Attorney General Eric Holder sent him essentially a two-letter answer, N-O. I mean, he basically a two-sentence answer saying the answer to your question is no. And that's all he said he wanted, and he got it. So we now have civil libertarians on both the far right and the left, which is civil liberties is often where the two ideologies come to meet. They got the assurance they wanted.
Okay, David Hawkins, Robert Costa, we're going to come back and continue our conversation with both of you. We'll have other guests as well as we talk about the future of the Republican Party and the new and the old. If you consider old the Paul Ryan budget and new what Rand Paul has to say about foreign policy. On Reporter's Notebook later, we'll be talking about China's new leadership, declaring its priorities and its challenges and admitting almost, at least, that it's made the old leadership has admitted it's made a lot of mistakes. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Talk about the president's charm offensive with the Republicans today. Some question as to whether that's going to last or whether it's going to be effective. We talked about Paul Ryan and his budget, and we've talked about Rand Paul and foreign affairs. We'll still have with us Robert Costa with the National Review, a Washington letter editor, also contributor to CNBC. You're going to be speaking at CPAC tonight, or soon at any rate. Tell us what CPAC is and what you intend to say there.
CPAC is an annual conservative conference, and it's really grown in the past few years. It's almost becoming a shadow convention for the Republican Party. But the key distinction is that it's not a partisan event. It's a conservative movement event. And so you have to interpret it as that. You have a lot of Republicans speaking, but it's really about the conservative movement. It's almost like a carnival or a fair. There's not just speeches, but there's a whole assembly of conservative groups that have stands selling T-shirts, giving out pamphlets. It's quite a wild scene. I'm speaking on Saturday about the future of the conservative movement. And it's just a time to really, if you're interested in politics, it's almost great after an election loss, when Republicans lose, they really have to rethink the future. And so CPAC this year is going to be about highlighting certain rising stars, such as Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Paul Ryan. It's also about saluting past favorites. Mitt Romney's giving his first speech since the defeat. Sarah Palin's coming back to give a speech. But it's really some of these smaller panels, like the one I'm on and other National Review writers are on, that's about articulating and thinking about conservatism in the 2013 Obama era.
Okay. We've heard that Paul Ryan would appear, at least at the moment, to be thinking backwards rather than forwards, if you look at it that way. He lost the campaign. Mitt Romney is going to speak. But Chris Christie, who is regarded as a very viable 2016 candidate, the governor of New Jersey, hasn't even been invited.
That's right. And the Christie decision is surprising because he remains a favorite of many Republicans and conservatives. But CPAC is run by a group called the American Conservative Union. The chairman of the ACU is a man named Al Cardenas. He's close with Senator Marco Rubio. He's a longtime Florida Republican operative and donor and strategist. And ACU has its own perspective on certain Republican politicians. They don't seem to be much in favor of Christie, and so he was not invited to attend. And that it really showcases the difference between this CPAC and the Republican National Convention. It's not about the party. It's about the ACU and the conservative movement. And Christie, because of how he became friendly with the president in the eyes of many conservatives, fairly or unfairly, got hit as someone who's just not a favorite as much as he was in 2009 and 2010.
Is that partly because he threw his arms around President Obama over the storm damage issue in his state?
I think so. I think it's a little much. I report on conservative politics for National Review, and I think that the anger towards Christie is somewhat unmerited. He has a very conservative fiscal record in the state. The way he battled the unions, the teachers' unions, and others, he's almost like a Scott Walker figure within the Republican Party. But so much now in politics, as ever, perhaps, depends on personality. And Christie is just simply not clicking with conservatives in the way he used to.
Okay. Robert Costa, National Review, Washington editor, contributor to CNBC. You need to leave us, as I understand it. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you for the invitation.
Let me introduce Daniel McCarthy. He's editor of The American Conservative. That bills itself as a magazine of ideas over ideology and principles over party. Daniel McCarthy, good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you, Warren.
Is the CPAC making a mistake by not asking Christie, or is this faithful to the idea of a principle over party?
No, I think they are making a mistake, and it was probably a mistake that they made, you know, very early on, before they'd really finalized exactly what they wanted to do for CPAC this year. There was a little bit of reaction that was quite negative to, Chris Christie's embrace of Obama, as it was seen during the Hurricane Sandy business. So I think at that time, a lot of the activists who have a great say in deciding what happens in CPAC, at that time wanted to blacklist or blackball Chris Christie. And over time, we've seen that I think the conservative base and most activists have been able to get over some of their upset with Christie as the election fades in memory. So it's something that I wonder if CPAC would be making the same decision if they were setting everything up today as opposed to the way they set it up a few months ago.
Well, what about the rethinking that has obviously been going on, at least on the part of some members of the party, particularly Rand Paul, who really has challenged the establishment of the party in a number of ways. One, saying that people are tired of war, including Republicans, and two, saying that during the Bush and Cheney years, it may well be they abrogated too much power to the White House, the executive branch.
No, that's quite right. And in fact, what you're seeing is almost a kind of dialectical process where Rand Paul is taking a lot of the very innovative and quite surprising ideas that came from his father's presidential campaigns in 2008 and 2012, ideas that often set the Republicans' teeth on edge, that seemed either very libertarian or very civil libertarian and not necessarily a good fit for some of the emphases that the party has had over the past decade with George W. Bush and with John McCain. So what Rand Paul is doing is taking a set of ideas that his father had sort of innovated and is also taking the Republican mainstream and is trying to fuse those two things together. And I think that's what makes Rand Paul such an interesting and dynamic figure and a figure who looks like he's going to be a major player in 2016.
So it's good then to challenge the orthodoxy and go in a new direction?
Well, it certainly is. And what you see happening, I think, both with Ron Paul and now with his son Rand, is that they're not just challenging the orthodoxy, but they're actually trying to go back to, in many cases, the sources. So certainly many conservatives see Barry Goldwater as someone who had civil libertarian inclinations. If you look at someone like Robert A. Taft, who was the great Republican leader in the Senate in the 1940s and 50s, you can see a very different take on foreign policy than that is what has characterized the Republican Party in the last 20 or 30 years. So I think it's not just innovation and unorthodoxy, but it's also a look back at the history of the conservative movement and Republican Party and a sense that there may be some ideas that have fallen out over the course of the decades which actually deserve to be rediscovered and put back into play.
Let me ask you about another call for change coming from Arthur C. Brooks. He is the president of the American Enterprise Institute, long regarded as a bastion of conservative thinking. In the Wall Street Journal, he has written that the image of the GOP now is that it is a representative of the wealthy upper class as opposed to everybody else. That was the image that Mitt Romney purveyed personally and in his campaign, and that it is time to make some changes in that regard, and that we should be, we Republicans, he is suggesting, focusing on the concerns of working and middle-class Americans, not attacking the social programs that are so popular with them, but rather saying that they need to be shored up financially, because the big problem is that if they go out of business, they won't be able to serve the poor anymore or the downtrodden, and that the Republicans should be taking that kind of an attitude, sort of a Teddy Roosevelt approach, and also get rid of what he refers to at great length as corporate welfare. Do you agree with that?
Well, I largely do, although you can see here a fault line within the conservative movement and Republican Party, where there are some people who have a very programmatic and highly conceptualized view of how a free market works, and then you have others who are much more pragmatic and willing to make concessions to the welfare state. And historically, the GOP has tried to keep both of those wings together. The way it's often been able to do it is by presenting a rather friendly face on free market policies, at least relatively free market policies. So, for example, when you had someone like George W. Bush presenting a case for, supply side economics or tax cuts, he was doing it as someone who had a public image of being, quite sincerely Christian and whose faith would supply the kind of compassion that pure free market economics might not. The Republicans have kind of stumbled into a paradox in the last 5 or 10 years here, where that has worn away, and instead of the libertarians or the economic conservatives bringing a sense of efficiency to things, and the Christian conservatives bringing a sense of compassion, instead the coalition is now getting the worst of both worlds, where the libertarians are seen as bringing a kind of heartless ruthlessness, and the Christian conservatives are often seen as bringing a kind of intolerance. So it's partly not just a function of which issues are privileged in this discussion, but it's also a matter of how they're presented and in what mixture.
What about the idea also expressed once again by the president of the American Enterprise Institute, Arthur C. Brooks, of getting rid of breaking up, I should say, the banks that have become not just too big to fail, but too big to manage or too complex to manage? He says the five largest banks now hold 60% of our economy, or assets equal to that, which he calls a highly dangerous concentration of power.
There's a lot of grassroots conservative support for that kind of thing, and it tends not to get expressed for a variety of reasons. But in fact, one hears rumblings from conservative activists all around the country. It's an issue that's important for conservatives because what it does is it helps break out of this idea that conservative principles in the Republican Party are necessarily completely identical. One of the things that I think Ron Paul and now Rand Paul did quite effectively is by bringing up issues like civil liberties, they were able to show a sense that they cared about the governance of the country and that they were not simply trying to score partisan points. And I think breaking up the banks and the difficulties that our financial system is facing also has the possibility of breaking out of this kind of cynical view that people have of the two-party contest.
Daniel McCarthy, again, editor of the American Conservative. Jeffrey Lord is a former Reagan White House political director. He's now author and contributing editor to the conservative American Spectator magazine. Good to have you on our program as well.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Do you think that these suggestions, such as those by Arthur C. Brooks and by Rand Paul and others in the party, are good, that the party ought to be moving in a different direction, perhaps even co-opting some of the programs that Democrats have always supported?
Well, I do think that some of these things are good in this sense. I too, as a Reaganite, was somewhat disheartened by the Bush years. From a Reaganite's position, this is the kind of thing that President Reagan was fighting within the Republican Party for all of his career. This is the case that he took against Gerald Ford in the 1976 Republican primaries and lost. And then he took it again in 1980 to George H.W. Bush and defeated him. So there is, I think, a considerable feeling with the people that I used to work with in the Reagan White House that it's time to get past the Bush era and get back to fundamentals, that when we talk about, as a number of people do, that Republicans have lost, Republican nominees have lost the popular vote in five out of the last six elections, I would say, yes, that's true, and they were all moderate Republicans, and there's a reason for it. And when you include President George W. Bush's two wins, one of which by the grace of the Supreme Court and the other by 100,000 votes in Ohio, those weren't exactly Reagan-esque landslides either. And I think there's a reason for it, and I do think that that Rand Paul is talking about some of this. I think that Arthur Brooks is talking about some of it. I would not personally, I mean, I think one of the problems with moderate Republicanism is it basically takes an idea from the left and then says, well, let's tinker it or manage it better. And I hear that a little bit when I listen to what Arthur Brooks is saying. And Rand Paul, I think in terms of foreign policy, I would go back to the Reagan era mantra of peace through strength. I mean, Ronald Reagan didn't send troops all over the world every single time there was a problem. He didn't send them to Nicaragua. He didn't. He took them out of Lebanon. I mean, I think he realized this was going to be a problem, and he took them out.
He wasn't allowed to take them to Nicaragua. The Congress had something to do with that, didn't it?
Right, but I mean, he was never suggesting that he wanted to send troops to Nicaragua. That was not his. His thing there. And I think that, you know, that turned out to be a very successful presidency. I mean, I must say, we're going to have Judge. I'm not going to be able to go to CPAC this year. I was a speaker last year, but I think that, you know, we're going to have Jeb Bush there this year. And one of the things that, you know, is noted here is that both President Bushes left the White House not in the greatest shape politically. President Bush, 41, was got 37% of the vote his second time around after governing like a moderate. President Bush, 43, left with his popularity somewhere in the 30s. And as I've written in a column, everybody from the President of the United States on down to the local dog catcher runs against President Bush. You know, whether it's the economy or a lost dog, they always say it was Bush's fault. Ronald Reagan, on the other hand, left with 63% of the vote, and to this day is a sort of golden asset, politically speaking, for Republicans. So I think we could learn a lot by going back to our fundamentals in that case.
But here you have a divided government with the Democrats holding the White House and the Senate and the Republicans holding the Congress. Earlier on this program, we heard President Obama say that I'm trying to create an atmosphere where Democrats and Republicans can go ahead, get together, and get something done. If you hold firmly to a principle, is it possible to compromise? And do you then lay yourself open to charges of creating gridlock and making it impossible for problems to be coped with?
The American government moves in inches, not by miles. And I think that one of the things that President Obama has failed miserably at is the attitude that he brought with him. I mean, you can bring your own individual set of principles to the office, but you compare him to somebody like either Ronald Reagan or Lyndon Johnson, one a conservative and the other a liberal. Both of those presidents worked Congress like there was no tomorrow right from the beginning. Every night when President Reagan left the Oval Office, he left with a thick folder, a call list, and he would call members of Congress personally. We had them up there to Capitol Hill, up to the White, down to the White House, for him to talk to. I mean, he would get these people all over the globe in their districts, et cetera, on talk radio shows, interrupt the talk radio shows to ask them for votes and talk with them. Lyndon Johnson, you know, as we now know from these tapes that came out a number of years ago, was a past master at working members of Congress. President Obama doesn't seem to like to do that. And I think that that, along with his political issues, has lent him has given him a real credibility problem here. And I think it makes it difficult for him now, 6 years in or 5 years in, to suddenly turn around and do it. I think there's a lot of mistrust there, and that's a problem.
Daniel McCarthy, quickly back to you. We're running very short of time here, but would the Republicans be better off sticking to principle, as Jeffrey Lord suggests and as your magazine, The American Conservative, suggests should be done? Or as far as the party is concerned, is it necessary to make some compromises? And does the president of the American Enterprise Institute have some good ideas about that?
Well, the trick is to find a way to be principled and still communicate to a large number of Americans. And I think going back to the sources, looking back not just to Ronald Reagan, but even further back to the civil libertarianism of Barry Goldwater or to Robert A. Taft's non-interventionist foreign policy, will take conservative principles and present them in a light that really hasn't been seen in a while, and will make them much more popular, especially with young people, and will really break the Republican Party into some demographics that right now it's been excluded from.
And Jeffrey Lord, is that the way to go?
Well, I hesitate a little, knowing that my friend Daniel here was a Ron Paul guy. I hesitate a little bit because I did oppose Ron Paul's foreign policy. To me, it smacked of George McGovern and old-fashioned leftism. So I do hesitate a little bit on that. But I certainly do think there's nothing wrong with taking a look at America's position in the world militarily and, you know, streamlining ourselves for the 21st century. We don't have to go running around every place, every time, and do everything. But we do have to be a leader. I think that by default, it's left to us. And when we don't do it, I think we have a lot of problems in the world.
Okay. New ideas and old ideas in the Republican Party. Thank you all very much for being with us. Jeffrey Lord, formerly with the Reagan White House, now contributor to the American Spectator magazine. Daniel McCarthy, editor of the American Conservative, and our other guests, Robert Costa and David Hawkins. Good to have all of you with us, and thanks very much. China's leadership change is a two-week process that began with praise for the work of the past year by Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, but outgoing President Hu Jintao then listed the multitude of problems that face his successors. We'll get an assessment of his legacy and the road ahead in a moment on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. There is unsustainable development in China. There is gaping income inequality. There's corruption. There's pollution. There's dominant state-owned enterprises that stifle innovation. Those are just some of the issues mentioned by the outgoing president, Hu Jintao. Has he been a failure? That's a question raised by Matt Schiavenza in The Atlantic magazine. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You would not hear most outgoing presidents say that to their successors or in front of their successors. Has this ever been done before in China?
Not usually, no. In fact, throughout Chinese history, or at least recent Chinese history, leaders have not necessarily been candid in that way to the degree that Hu has. They've usually tried to come up with a whitewash of sorts, most notably Deng Xiaoping, who was the leader of China in the 70s and 80s, referred to his predecessor, Chairman Mao, as being 70% good. And that's been the typical model for Chinese politicians to talk about, you know, the leadership and the problems. But Hu has been quite candid, which is a little bit of a surprise.
Sounds like he has not been 70. Maybe he's been 35% good, or is anybody putting a number on it?
Well, it's actually a matter of some controversy. For one thing, on the surface, Hu has actually been pretty successful. The Chinese economy grew by more than 8% each year that he was president. And that included the financial crisis when the West really suffered after the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008, China kind of sprung into action much more quickly than the United States and other countries did. And so on the surface, Hu's record was quite good across the board, but there were just a number of other problems beneath the surface that led to him being somewhat less than glowing in his own assessment.
So what are some of the things that need to be dealt with first? And how do they, particularly the domestic issues that that I listed, how do they, can they be reconciled with the idea of doing more military spending?
Well, it's going to be quite difficult. And I think in terms of military spending, the Chinese can manage. They do have the ability to raise a lot of money. And in terms of their overall financial health, that isn't so much the problem. But what is the problem is the systematic setup of the government. And it for tackling an issue like corruption, Xi Jinping, who is the incoming president, is paying lip service to it. But really, the government is set up in a way that lower-level officials have incentives to be corrupt and that there isn't the kind of oversight that you might see in a more transparent system of government. And that is something that nobody in the Chinese government has answers for, alas.
So the incentives can't be dealt with unless there's more transparency, and obviously the people who are corrupt don't want to see that.
That's right. So most Chinese officials have a vested interest to produce economic growth at all costs. That's what gets them promoted within China's bureaucracy. And they don't. However they manage to do that is typically not really a problem. It's not really scrutinized in such a degree. And that leads to things like municipal debt spending and other forms of off-balance sheet banking and things of that nature that really sort of must paper over China's true economic picture.
What about one of the problems that that you can actually take pictures of and that everybody knows about because they have to try to breathe in Beijing, that air pollution and the other kind of pollution as well? How difficult is it going to be to deal with that?
Very difficult. There is a pressing need for it, but China has to keep building factories. It has to keep growing economically. It has to keep manufacturing. These are the engines of China's economy, and we haven't had the technological breakthrough so that China can shift toward more renewable sources of energy, although they're trying. So they're in a bind. The pollution is ugly. It's a problem, but China is unwilling to upend its economic model just to stop the pollution. At the moment, it's something that they're willing to live with.
And when you talk about what you refer to as the systematic setup, what about this issue of the state-owned enterprises that are so dominant that innovation is sometimes crushed by them? Is that also a problem that is separate from corruption, or is it all part of the same thing?
It's more or less all part of the same thing. The state-owned enterprises in China are funneled a lot of cheap cash, which is mostly culled from household savings, and they are quite inefficient. But the problem is that in China's system, should the government really press forward with liberalizing and privatizing a lot of the state-owned industries, it would cause quite a bit of social instability. And social instability is the single thing that China's government cannot abide by. It's the single thing that they try to avoid most. So they have an incentive to keep these state-owned enterprises alive, even though they're inefficient, and that they're actually something of a drain on the economy as a whole.
So we've talked about the challenges. What about the legacy? And has the outgoing president, do you think, been a success or a failure?
Well, it's too early to tell, as always with these things. I do think that, well, Hu Jintao is not somebody that, I mean, he did exactly as you would have expected him to do. He wasn't somebody that made a lot of unthinkable mistakes. He wasn't reckless. He was, in fact, quite the opposite. He was very predictable. But I do think that he has put his successor, Xi Jinping, into a difficult position because she will now, I mean, China is on an unsustainable trajectory, in my view, that and the problems that have popped up in Hu's tenure, such as the anti-corruption demonstrations and the various growing inequality and environmental problems, will only be worse during Xi's administration. So in that sense, Hu didn't, in my view, didn't do a good enough job writing the course for future Chinese leaders.
Has Xi indicated that he wants to tackle all of these things? Has he suggested any sort of path forward?
He has paid, as I said, he's paid lip service to it. And for example, with corruption, he's done away with a lot of the pomp that used to accompany Chinese political events. And he has explicitly stated on many occasions that corruption is going to be something he deals with very much. But there's just a limit to how much Xi can accomplish. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party is a massive bureaucracy. It is very firmly entrenched. And although Xi sits at the top of that organization, he by no means has any form of unilateral power, and he must deal with various factions within the government that want to maintain the status quo.
What about relations with the United States and impact on the United States of this change in leadership? How profound will that be?
I would suspect that the relations, the Sino-American relations, will pretty much remain the same. There is some sense that Xi is a much more cosmopolitan figure than Hu was, and that, you know, Xi spent a bit of time in Iowa when he was younger. He's a little bit more comfortable with foreign leaders. But in terms, the Sino-American relationship or their foreign policy is very much set in motion, and Xi will face a lot of pressure, both from the Chinese military and for the people, to press forward with China's defense of its territory in the East China Sea and for what China views as its national interest in foreign policy.
All right. Just should add that Xi is the name of the next leader of China. Confusion over the pronoun. Matt Schiavenza, good to have you on our program. Associate editor of The Atlantic Magazine, overseeing the China Channel blog. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper, Carrie Cavanaugh, and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Americans are living in changing times, economically, politically, and socially. I'm Warren Alney. On To the Point, we'll tackle the tough issues with conflicting opinions that challenge, illuminate, and help you make up your own mind. Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.